Now, Stephen Campbell Moore reads the final instalment of Chopin, Prince of the Romantics by Adam Zamoyski. Today, after the inevitable breakdown of his relationship with George Sand, Chopin finds himself back in Paris, where Europe is once again being ravaged by political unrest.
On February the 22nd, 1848, revolution broke out in Paris. Chopin was feeling ill and lay in bed listening to the fighting that engulfed the capital for 2 days, at the end of which King Louis-Philippe fled for the coast, taking a ship for England. The court that had patronized Chopin had gone, and the climate of instability frightened him, as well as threatening his livelihood. The prospect of spending another summer in Paris was not one to which he looked forward. The only place in Europe that seemed immune to disturbance was England. One of his pupils, a Scottish woman called Jane Stirling, hotly advocated the idea of taking in the London season. He duly arrived in London on the 20th of April, which happened to be Maundy Thursday. He found the city quiet and dreary, but the coal smoke made an immense impression on his lungs. He had rooms in Dover Street, off Piccadilly. His playel piano was unpacked, and he began paying calls on acquaintances and on those to whom he had been given letters of introduction. He visited Chevalier d'Orsay at Kensington Gore, went to Cheyne Row to see Thomas Carlyle, met Charles Dickens and Lady Byron. At the opera he was impressed by the figure of the young queen, more so still by Wellington in the box below the queen's, like an old monarchist watchdog. Expensive as he was for the English market, Chopin did not lack pupils. "They all look at their hands and play the wrong notes, with feeling," he quipped. By the middle of the season, he was giving up to 5 lessons a day, and since there was no shortage of demand for him to play at soirees, he was doing well financially. All this led Chopin to consider the possibility of staying on and even settling in England. But as he put it, "These English are so different from the French, whom I have grown to accept as my own people. They're so pound-conscious in everything, liking the arts because they represent luxury." The aristocracy, he added, though cultivated, were brought up to treat music as background noise. There was music at every social function, and the local musicians allowed themselves to be treated as servants. "If you say you're an artist, the Englishman will think you're a painter, a sculptor or an architect. No musician will be called an artist in word or print, because in their view, it is not an art, but a profession." To his family, he put it more practically. "If London were not quite so black, the people not quite so heavy, and if there was no smell of coal and no fog, I would probably start learning English." The climate was the crucial factor. "Often in the morning, I think I'm going to cough up my very soul." In the first days of August, he went to Edinburgh, where he spent the day sightseeing, and then to Calderhouse in Midlothian to stay with Jane Stirling's brother-in-law. "The park here is very beautiful, the host very excellent, and I am as well as can be," Chopin wrote. But this was not very well. After a week, he was coughing badly, and he was soon on the move again. After visiting Manchester, Jane Stirling then took him to stay with one of her sisters at Johnston Castle. There was a large house party there, but this did little to cheer Chopin, who found himself stuck indoors all day with the old and infirm, while the younger guests were out shooting the grouse. He had not written a single piece for over 6 months. "Not one musical thought. I feel like a donkey at a masked ball, or a violin bow trying to play a double bass." And to him, the comfort and easygoing atmosphere of these house parties was exhausting. "I sit here panting until dinner time, after which one has to sit for 2 hours with the men at the table and listen to them drinking, bored to tears. Oh, I then go to the drawing room, where I need all my strength of mind to come to life a little, for they always want to hear me play. After that, my servant carries me up the stairs to my bedroom and leaves me to pant and dream till morning." He was by now desperate to leave Scotland, and not just on account of the cold weather. And Mrs. Erskine had decided to convert him to the Church of Scotland and drove him mad with Bible readings while her sister Jane Stirling revealed other intentions. Chopin was used to being pampered by women and had not realised that she was in love with him. When it became obvious, he told her firmly that he had no intentions of going beyond friendship, but this did not put her off. "My Scottish ladies are kind, but such bores! God help me!" Rumours even reached Paris, whence an alarmed Gajimler wrote to inquire the truth. Chopin answered that he was closer to the grave than to the nuptial bed. At the end of October, he returned to London, where he promptly fell ill. His desire to leave London was reinforced by the arrival in November of Jane Stirling and her pious sister. "One day longer here and I won't just die. I'll go mad," he wrote to Gajimler. "My Scottish ladies, God preserve me, have latched on so tight that I cannot get away." He asked Gajimler to prepare his rooms in the Square d'Orléans and to place a bouquet of violets, his favourite flowers, in the drawing room. "At least I can have a breath of poetry when I return, as I pass on to my bedroom, where I shall probably lie down for a very long time." When Chopin arrived at the Square d'Orléans, Gajimler was there to meet him. He was home at last. But Chopin's relief at getting back to Paris was not accompanied by any improvement in his health. Much had changed in Paris while he had been away. The radical Republicans had been toppled, and 2 weeks after Chopin's return, Louis Napoleon Bonaparte would be elected President of the Republic. Most of Chopin's French pupils had now left the city, and he was now limiting his lessons to advanced pupils and those prepared to put up with last-minute cancellations on account of his health. Although he could go out only rarely that winter, Chopin did not suffer from the loneliness he had dreaded. Delacroix used to call on "my poor, great, dying man," as he referred to him. He would often come to informal evenings at the Square d'Orléans, or drop in late in the day when he knew Chopin would have finished giving lessons, and the two would talk for hours about life, art, and Georges Sand. On other days, Delacroix would find Chopin hardly breathing and unable to move. On better days, Chopin also tried to compose, but he found it difficult to concentrate. The fruits of these labours, the mazurkas No. 2 of Opus 67 and No. 4 of Opus 68, bear the mark of this. The doctors treating him decided that it would be madness for him to remain in Paris during the summer months, when the heat and dust would make it difficult for him to breathe. As a result, his friends found him an apartment in Chaillot. He moved in at the end of May, and his spirits rose. He liked the spacious main room and the magnificent Roman view afforded by the windows of the apartment, which took in the Tuileries, Notre Dame, the Pantheon, and the Invalides. June passed pleasantly enough, and Delacroix left Paris for the summer, wondering sadly whether he would ever see Chopin again. And the Scottish ladies had reappeared on the scene. "They will drive me into my grave," Chopin could not help complaining to Gajimler. In the last week of June, Chopin started hemorrhaging dramatically, and his legs began to swell. The symptoms were consistent with the final stages of tuberculosis. Chopin must have realised that the end was near, for while he made brave noises about going to Poland in the spring, he began to make desperate appeals to his sister Ludwika to come to Paris. "I'm very weak, and no doctor can help me as much as you can," he wrote, telling her to bring her needle and thimble, for there would be much sitting at his bedside. Chopin alternated between anticipation of death and the denial of the severity of his condition. The doctors declared that if he was to survive the winter at all, he must be found a warm, sunny apartment in central Paris. At the end of September, Chopin moved to No. 12, Place Vendôme. The rooms were warm and sunny as the windows faced south. Although he was once or twice well enough to wander about the apartment, he never left it. Death was closing in fast, and his friends knew it. Aside from his sister Ludwika, who had moved in with him, he was attended by Georges Sand's daughter Solange, who had come up to Paris especially, and his former pupil, Princess Marcelina. His condition continued to deteriorate, but although he was choking much of the time, he was entirely lucid and admitted to his bedside many of his friends and pupils who came to say farewell. Dozens simply called in at the apartment as a mark of respect. The singer Pauline Viardot wrote to Georges Sand that all the grand dames of Paris feel obliged to come and faint in his room. Georges Sand developed the theme. My poor sick friend died in the arms of pious women, she wrote, adding that they made him kiss relics while he thought only of the music to be played at the funeral. Chopin did indeed attend to such details and gave careful instructions about his affairs. He asked that all unfinished musical scripts be destroyed and that only complete pieces be published. He begged that his body be cut open out of a widely shared horror of being buried alive and that his heart be sent to Warsaw. And he asked for Mozart's Requiem to be sung at his funeral. Throughout his final illness, he craved music and seemed to draw strength from it. His friends played him some Mozart, and then Chopin asked to hear his own sonata for the piano and cello. But after a few bars, he began to suffocate. The end came at about 2 o'clock in the morning of the 17th of October. Ludwika had fallen asleep, but Chopin lay awake and Georges Sand's daughter Solange sat holding his hand. Don't stay here. This will be ugly. You must not see it, he suddenly said to her. And then he appeared to have a seizure. He passed away with his gaze fixed on me. He was hideous, wrote Solange. Oh, the soul had died too. The following morning, Auguste Clésinger, the sculptor, turned up to make a death mask. The mask was so painfully eloquent of the agonized death throes of the composer that he put it aside and produced a doctored version. The soul of an angel cast down upon earth in a tortured body in order to accomplish some mysterious redemption, was how Solange remembered him. Is it because his life was a 39-year agony that his music is so lofty, so sweet, so sublime?
Chopin, Prince of the Romantics by Adam Zamoyski was read by Stephen Campbell Moore. It was abridged by Doreen Estel and the producer was Justine Willett. Next week, we've Richard Ingram's biography of a one-man force of the early 1800s. The renowned author, political reformer and ardent agriculturalist, the life and adventures of William Cobbett is next week's reading.
For 1942's greatest picture, the famous Mrs. Miniver.
For BBC Radio 4, Paul Gambaccini hears the stories behind Academy Award-winning pictures.
He did not feel burdened by the need to make a balanced movie. Mrs. Miniver obviously was a propaganda film.
I think they felt that going to see it was a patriotic duty.
Now you're ready for real flying.
Oh, not only for real flying, but real... well, whatever they send me into.
Fighting.
And the Academy Award goes to... over on BBC Radio 4, tomorrow morning at 10:30.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
This is Cathy Clugston at 3 o'clock. Hello. Carolyn Pickles stars in our thriller next. Then Mel Gedroidge walks in J.M. Barrie's footsteps in the 4 o'clock show. Our drama tonight tells the story of Bulldog, an elderly man with a colourful past who's waiting for the arrival of the council's sitter. An unlikely friendship is forged in The Sitter by Peter Tinniswood, starring Maurice Denham, at 9:15. Now, a thriller set in a fictional college in Cambridge University. The college is home to a fine library, which is worth a fortune, but something sinister has been happening amid the priceless collection of books.
We present The Wyndham Case by Jill Peyton Walsh, dramatised for radio by Neville Teller, with Carolyn Pickles as Imogen Quay.
People speak of killing time, but sometimes the boot's on the other foot, and it's time that kills. Thinking back, I believe I can pinpoint the moment when death, concealed and cunning, first insinuated itself into St. Agatha's College, Cambridge. It was an evening in November 1999. Michaelmas term still had half its life to run. The same, alas, couldn't be said of poor Philip Skellow. A potential new benefactor, Lord Goldhooper, had suddenly appeared, offering the college some £5 million. And the master, Sir William Buckmoat, had invited a few people to dinner to entertain him. As college nurse, I had no real place at the table, but Lady B had begged me to balance the predominantly male guest list.
Imogen, dear, I'll be the only woman. Do please help me out.
Oh, yes, death was sly. Not one of us suspected the moment when, masked by the more or less idle chatter, he slid in amongst us.
But what is the Wyndham case, Master?
Would you believe me, Lord Goldhooper, if I told you it was a rather large and somewhat unusual bookcase?
Oh, isn't that rather misleading, William dear?
Nor, Master, does it do justice to one of St. Agatha's most respected traditions.
Oh, come off it, Crispin. I'm afraid, Lord Goldhooper, that Mr. Mountnessing must be considered somewhat biased. He holds the rather arcane and much too highly rewarded post of Wyndham Librarian.
Mr. Rumbold, on the other hand, is what might be termed St. Agatha's Common or Garden Librarian.
And, I may add, much less richly remunerated.
I seem to have stirred up a hornet's nest, Master. I assure you I had no intention of doing...
A dispute hallowed by time, Lord Goldhooper. Indeed, 3 centuries. The Wyndham case is one of those rather embarrassing pieces of baggage from a bygone era that so many of our Cambridge colleges are encumbered with.
I'm afraid Lord Goldhooper will be getting a misleading impression of how much we welcome bequests to the college and how scrupulous we are in carrying out the terms attached to them.
And that would never do, would it, Mr. Mountnessy? In view of the rather special conditions I'd attach to my own donation?
Actually, Lord Goldhooper, I was wondering if you include medicine among the subjects you'd prescribe under the terms of your bequest.
As our college nurse, Miss Quay would be considered to have a vested interest in medicine.
Quay? An unusual name?
Saxon, I believe. And from this part of the world. Quay's a village in East Anglia. Mm-hmm.
Well, Miss Quay, I'm afraid I class theoretical medicine along with all the other soft sciences, sociology, economics, and the rest of the tommy rot that passes for academic study these days. I want my 3 chairs and 9 scholarships to advance the sort of science capable of returning precise answers to precise questions. Physics, astronomy, inorganic chemistry.
In fact, Lord Goldhooper, your approach closely parallels Christopher Wyndham's. He was a Ptolemaic astronomer, and he also imposed certain conditions when he bequeathed St. Agatha's his unique library of works on that branch of science.
Perhaps I should explain that the Wyndham case was given to the college as a complete library, together with the rather magnificent oak bookcase that holds it. You must come and see it. It's two stories high, with steps at one end, and even a little gallery. Fortunately, we have a room large enough to contain it.
You said your benefactor imposed certain conditions.
Yes. Well, Wyndham lived to see the values he believed in being systematically destroyed. Isaac Newton's Principia was taking the world by storm, and the Ptolemaic system was in disrepute. Above everything, Wyndham wanted the body of knowledge that he'd gathered together to be preserved precisely as he left it.
So,